from the classroom to the emergency room, OR and beyond. You're joining Trauma ICU Rounds with your host, Dr. Dennis Kim.
For this talk, I was actually going through previous PowerPoints and presentations to see what I could scavenge and incorporate into this one. And I realized that it's been approximately 5 years to the month that I actually gave my first grand rounds at UCLA. And so it's a real honor to be invited back to share with you a little bit in terms of what's been happening kind of behind the scenes as well as on the scenes with regards to endpoints of resuscitation. And whether you're a trauma surgeon, an anesthesia intensivist, or an emergency medicine physician or healthcare professional, I think understanding the importance of determining which endpoints we want to use in the resuscitation of our patients is critically important. And so over the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to go over some of the state of the art in terms of the various hemodynamic, metabolic, as well as regional endpoints of resuscitation. And I have no disclosures. And in terms of the outline for this talk, we're going to first talk about shock. And of course, this will be a general overview of what we mean by shock, the classification of shock, as well as stages of shock. And then the vast majority of this talk is really going to focus in on endpoints of resuscitation. And as I mentioned, there's three key endpoints. And the vast majority of this discussion is going to focus on hemodynamics, because I think this is really where there's been a lot of progress made in terms of how we can apply both static, but more importantly, dynamic measures of fluid responsiveness in order to determine our endpoints of resuscitation and kind of find that balance between where we want to start to throttle back in terms of our volume and crystalloid resuscitation and start to think about deresuscitation, which is becoming a more important topic these days. You know, in the past, we used to say you have to swell to get well. These days, the saying is now you got to pee to be free. And that's sort of coming off the ventilator, avoiding iatrogenic ARDS volume overload and the attendant complications associated with aggressive fluid administration. More and more these days, we're talking about hemostatic resuscitation and hemorrhage control. And I think this really has become one of the sort of fourth endpoints of resuscitation. If we're doing a really good job with a bad trauma or a bleeding emergency general surgery patient in the operating room, we should be getting hemorrhage control, and there should be evidence objectively of improved hemostasis. And so there's certainly a role for things like thromboelastography. So we'll touch upon that and then some final take-home points. So by the end of this presentation, I'm hoping that you'll have a better understanding of the pathophysiology as well as classification of shock. Also, you should be able to discuss the strengths and various weaknesses of the various resuscitation endpoints that will be discussed. And then finally, understand the importance of clinical context in deciding upon endpoints. And I really can't emphasize this enough. Someone coming in with a severe TBI, GCS less than 8 with no other injuries is going to have very different resuscitation endpoints than a patient who's coming in with multiple GSWs to the torso. In the first scenario, we're going to make sure that we're augmenting the mean arterial pressure so that we have an adequate CPP or cerebral perfusion pressure based on what the patient's ICPs are. And we're typically targeting in a young trauma patient, for example, a CPP of, let's say, 60 millimeters of mercury. Well, that's very different than the patient coming in with penetrating torso trauma in whom, in fact, if they've got a palpable pulse and they're arousable, we're not going to aggressively intervene until we can get definitive hemorrhage control. So I think the most important thing as we go through this talk is just to remember you got to focus in on the patient in front of you, and then that's going to help you decide what your endpoints of resuscitation should be. So talking about shock, I mean, this is how I conceptualize shock. It's very simple. You've got a little teeter-totter, and then there's this fine balance between oxygen supply or delivery and oxygen demand or consumption. And what is shock? Fundamentally, shock is the inadequate delivery of oxygen and perfusion with resultant tissue and cellular hypoxia. And you get that standard sort of shift from aerobic to anaerobic glycolysis, which we know is going to be accompanied by significant metabolic abnormalities, specifically the accumulation of lactate. And then we're getting much less bang for our buck in terms of production of ATP from a net 34 to much less than that when we shift into anaerobic glycolysis. And so when we're thinking about shock and when we're trying to intervene or help our patients out, the whole idea is that we want to both augment oxygen delivery, but at the same time, decrease demand. And I think that latter part oftentimes gets forgotten about. This is probably the most important and most discussed equation in terms of critical care medicine. And this is our DO2 or oxygen delivery equation. And the key thing here is that we have a pump or the cardiac output, and then we have what's being delivered by that pump, namely the arterial oxygen content. And we know that the key factors determining cardiac output are heart rate and stroke volume. And if you look at the order in which these are presented, preload, afterload, and contractility, well, when you think about patients with severe sepsis or septic shock, that in fact is the stepwise progression in terms of early resuscitation. We want to make sure that within the first hour, we're getting our patients their 30 cc per kg bolus. That's going to augment their preload, which ultimately improves their stroke volume and cardiac output. Once we've got that volume into them and we think that they're no longer going to be fluid responsive, and we'll talk about how we make that determination, then at that point, we're going to add vasopressors. And the endpoint here is typically 65 millimeters of mercury in terms of the mean arterial pressure, but that comes with several caveats. And I think too often we get fixated on that 65, even when the patient in front of us is 80 years old on 3 antihypertensives and normally has a driving pressure of 85. And then, of course, once we've sort of maxed out our patient on their norepinephrine, their vasopressin, plus or minus their angiotensin, then we're going to start thinking about contractility in the form of both epinephrine and or milrinone or dobutamine or some form of inodilator to improve the actual contractility of the heart. And again, in terms of patients with septic shock, we're not typically transfusing them like they did in the original Manny Rivers trial. We know based on great literature, including the TRIC trial, that really we're aiming for a hemoglobin of 7. Of course, we want to maximize oxygen saturations. And if you'll notice from this equation, the relative contribution of dissolved arterial oxygen really is non-significant. And so we're really focused on maintaining their saturations, ideally greater than 90%. They don't need to be 100%. And that's something that's also changed in terms of our critical care paradigm over the last several years. And it really comes down to this Goldilocks principle. You know, it's this fine balance. It's that teeter-totter. We want to make sure that patients are in this optimal zone. And all too often, especially in the setting of hemorrhagic shock, patients come in with hypovolemia. And as a result of that, they have organ hypoperfusion, which will result in dysfunction and poor outcomes, including mortality. But at the same time, if we're overly aggressive and overshoot, then patients also run into problems such as pulmonary edema or swelling in the kidneys with organ dysfunction and similar adverse outcomes. So we need to find that sort of delicate balance. And this is a recent clinical consensus guideline that we put out at the AAST, the Critical Care Committee. And what we really talked about was some of the endpoints that I'm going to go over today, including the hemodynamic endpoints, as well as some of the chemical or metabolic biomarkers. But one of the things that we really want to emphasize here is that we want to avoid overshooting euvolemia. And we're seeing this complication more and more. Unfortunately, based on the literature that we're seeing and some of the enhanced improvements in our understanding of hemorrhagic shock, this is becoming less of an issue as we've moved to a more one-to-one-to-one strategy of transfusion. And so when we classify shock, it really is on this spectrum and it goes through a few stages. And I don't think it's too important to really memorize or understand what these stages are. The big point here is that if we fail to recognize and intervene in a patient who has shock, which is a clinical spectrum of symptoms and signs, eventually that patient will progress to the point where that shock is irreversible or refractory to our therapies. And that's when mortality increases. It's very difficult, on the other hand, to identify patients in compensated shock because of that sympathetic response, the adrenergic response to, let's say, hypovolemia. Patients are automatically going to have increased vascular tone, which might make their blood pressure actually look quote unquote normal, or they may have minimal tachycardia. So it really requires a high index of suspicion to recognize these patients. By the time they moved along the spectrum here, I think with trained eyes, it's fairly straightforward to identify these patients. And so the trick is really to find them here. And this is a classic example of hemorrhagic shock progression, but this actually can be applied to any form of shock, whether that's cardiogenic versus any distributive causes. But, you know, in the first couple of stages of compensated shock, patients are able to actually continue to extract oxygen in the periphery. And just along the x-axis here, we should have O2 delivery, and on the y-axis, consumption. So you see that over a very wide spectrum, the body and the tissues and the capillary beds there can actually extract more and more oxygen in order to maintain their oxygen consumption. But there will come a point known as the critical DO2, whereby oxygen consumption really does become flow dependent or dependent on the delivery of oxygen. And this is where we get into that uncompensated and eventually refractory shock. So we want to avoid getting into these stages. And, you know, this is all very kind of abstract. And so the question becomes, well, how do I recognize that? And this is the American College of Surgeons classification of hemorrhagic shock. And, you know, these stages or classes are broken up based on the estimated blood loss, whether that's percent blood volume or absolute volume in terms of CC. And the big thing here you'll notice is that, not surprisingly, we want to look at vital signs. Even before that, I actually like to look at the patient themselves, because oftentimes just looking at your patient will give you quite a bit of information, and even touching your patient to assess for skin temperature, color, and the presence or absence of modeling. But what you'll notice is that between class one and class two shock, at least when it comes to blood pressure, you may not actually see much in terms of changes. I'm going to talk a little bit about pulse pressure and the utility of that. And again, that's really just the difference between your systolic and diastolic pressure. And assuming that 120 over 80 is a normal pulse pressure, 40, narrow pulse pressure may be defined as less than 30 millimeters of mercury. And the question becomes, is that helpful, or what's the utility of that in trauma patients? And we'll talk about that in just a minute. And then you have a number of other things that you can assess in terms of end organ perfusion. And I would say that Glasgow Coma Scale, or the presence of encephalopathy or confusion, is something that should always alert you to the potential presence of shock. It doesn't matter if the etiology is sepsis or hypovolemia. When patients are confused, never assume that that's due to intoxication or anything else. This is usually due to hypoxia or hypoxic encephalopathy until proven otherwise. Urine output, I think as surgeons, we're always taught when someone's in shock, you put in two large bore peripheral IVs and insert a Foley. But again, this is going to take time to give you information. So in real time, immediately, oftentimes it's not going to give you much valuable information. The base deficit is something we'll get into in a bit, but this is something that's been known in the trauma world to be very predictive, both of survival as well as improved outcomes in trauma patients. And so this iteration of ATLS, they actually added the base deficit, which is now the only biomarker in this entire classification of hemorrhage. The whole idea here is that patients in class 3 or 4 hemorrhage, they really need to be transfused. And then patients who are in class 1 or 2, you have some time and you can probably start with crystalloids, ideally less than a liter, and then calculation of their assessment of blood consumption score, which is a very easy risk stratification score to help you determine the need for a massive transfusion protocol. And that comes out of Vanderbilt and Dr. Brian Cotton's work. Now, earlier I talked about this teeter-totter and that fine balance between supply and demand. And one of the things that we oftentimes forget is the importance of decreasing demand. I can't tell you the number of times I've been to either the emergency room or another ICU or even the ward to assess a patient with intra-abdominal sepsis. And, you know, they're chugging along with a minute ventilation of 20 liters per minute, trying to maintain some normalcy in terms of their acid-base balance. And they've got all the usual things like the antibiotics on board, the lactate's been sent, they've gotten their fluids and they've gotten their antibiotics. And although we're helping in terms of oxygen delivery, there's no thought that, hey, you know, maybe this patient should be on a ventilator and maybe we should completely sedate and analgesia this patient, maybe even paralyze them for at least the first 24 hours. And why do I say that? Well, under normal basal conditions, our lungs or pulmonary system takes up anywhere from 3 to 5% of our cardiac output. When someone's in the throes of shock and they're chugging away, that work of breathing can increase by 5 to 8-fold. And so there's valuable oxygen going to the diaphragm and accessory muscles respiration that otherwise could be going to the brain, the kidneys, the liver. And so it's so important for us to remember simple things like treating pyrexia and fevers, ensuring that patients have a decreased work of breathing, ensuring that they're not having pain, because that in and of itself will also increase their demand. I think this classification system for shock still holds true today. Again, this is something that's been around for quite a long time based on the initial work by Dr. Alfred Blalock in the 1930s and then subsequently modified. And so again, the big categories here are hypovolemic, cardiogenic, distributive, and obstructive. Sometimes some folks, me in particular, I like to classify cardiogenic shock as either non-obstructive due to one of these causes or others, versus obstructive. As you'll notice, most of the obstructive causes actually have to do with right heart failure or acute core pulmonality. I think no talk on shock would really be complete without revisiting or discussing some of the significant contributions from surgeons with regards to fluids and volume resuscitation over the years. And some of the sort of prime work was done by Shires and Moss and the group out of Parkland. And in this original study in the 1960s, this is the paper where this concept of a third space that needed to be repleted during the resuscitation of exsanguinating canines or dogs really came into being. And I think people took this data and evidence and really kind of went overboard with it to the point where we were doing supernormal aggressive resuscitation of patients with crystalloids and salt solutions in an effort to replete their intravascular volume, not realizing the potential deleterious downstream effects of this strategy. And then in 1967, this case series all of Colorado really first described what was then known as the acute respiratory distress syndrome or the Nang Lung. And we started to realize just within the first 5 years or 6 years of that original publication that, hey, you know, overzealous fluid administration may not be a good thing. And in fact, several of the patients in this case series developed iatrogenic ARDS as a result of fluids. So much so that that same year, 1967, there was what's become known as the plea for moderation. And the whole idea behind this plea was that instead of using any rules of thumb and sort of blindly just tanking up our patients with crystalloids, the objective is really to restore normal physiology and normal function of organs. And I will say, in critically ill patients, striving for normalcy is probably not a good thing. Critical care patients shouldn't look normal, but closer to normal than abnormal. And again, this can never be accomplished by inundation. As we move to the 1970s, that's when Swan-Ganz catheters were conceived and came into being. And this opened up a whole new avenue for resuscitation research. And in fact, here at Harvard UCLA, we do have some history with this, and this is Dr. William Shoemaker, who was originally here as well as CDU, Charles Drew, and eventually ended up at USC. But in this pivotal or landmark 1988 study, they looked at trials of what they called supernormal values for high-risk surgical patients. And essentially, they broke down patients into three groups, either CVP-directed therapy, pulmonary artery catheter therapy, or pulmonary artery catheter protocol directed therapy. And what they did with patients is they really tanked them up with preload and volume optimization, and then put them on inodilators in order to augment their oxygen delivery. And the whole point here was to really improve that forward flow of oxygen. And what they found was in patients who were able to achieve these supernormal values, they actually had improved outcomes, less organ dysfunction, and mortality. Several subsequent meta-analyses looking at a more narrow spectrum of patients actually have shown that this might be helpful, But a lot of the criticisms behind this, and as you'll see with even just regular early goal-directed therapy, is oftentimes we're flogging our patients. And in patients who do well, it's because they have the underlying substrate to do so. And the patients who don't do well, well, they probably have some underlying compromised physiology to begin with. But I think this is important because it kind of looks at endpoints and really starts with these as a goal to see if that can actually result in improved outcomes in the perioperative period. And I think that this sort of protocolized care really set the stage for the work of people like Manny Rivers, as well as the subsequent studies that have come out since then. And for those of us who aren't familiar with Manny Rivers, and I'd be surprised if anyone wasn't, again, this is that original single center study in 2001 out of Detroit, where they had EM physicians, fellows, nurses kind of hanging out in the ED ready for patients with severe sepsis or septic shock to come in who got randomized to standard care or early goal-directed therapy. And several things have changed since 2001, but in that particular time, patients were getting lined up with central venous catheters that were capable of doing continuous SCVO2 monitoring. And they were sedated, paralyzed, and intubated, again, decreased their demand. And they went through this normal progression that we talked about. First, you want to fill the tank, then press the pipes. Here, they were transfusing to a crit greater than 30. We don't do that anymore. But eventually, they would start to work on contractility. And in this particular study, absolute mortality was decreased by 16%. I mean, we don't see those sorts of differences in trials these days. And since then, both the ARISE, PROMISE, and in addition to that, the PROCESS trial, which was actually done here in the US, have all shown that, in fact, when you compare a protocolized early goal-directed therapy approach versus standard of care, and that's present day or at least 5 years ago, there's really no difference in outcomes. Now, several criticisms can be laid against these sort of multi-institutional trials. The mortality incidence in these studies was about 20%, whereas in the original Manny Rivers studies, they were more along the lines of 40%, so probably less sick patients. But a lot has happened in the 14 or 15 years between the original early goal-directed therapy study and these studies. And so when you think about the early one-hour bundle, I mean, that's just become standard of care. And so these studies, in fact, lend some evidence that perhaps, especially in patients who are not very, very sick, that we don't need to be overly aggressive. Not everyone needs a central line, and we don't need to be monitoring SVO2s on all patients. Now, with that said, my feeling is that certain services and personnel have really taken that to the extreme. And so now, as you walk through certain ICUs, patients are all getting peripheral vasopressors. No one has an A line. No one has a central line. And I can't tell you the number of times on call where I've been asked to put in a central line in a non-surgical intensive care patient or an A line or help them interpret, you know, the results of a Swan-Ganz catheter reading. So again, I think the right answer lies somewhere in between these two extremes. So this year, based on some work that we did through the Critical Care Committee, the AAST, we were looking to define a surgical critical care research agenda moving forward. And essentially what we did is we performed a systematic review of the literature, and then we performed a modified Delphi to get a sense as to what our needs were as surgeons working in ICUs, covering trauma, ACS, and surgical critical care, what our priorities should be moving forward. And when you look at the top 10 priorities in terms of research and surgical critical care, three of them actually have to do with hemodynamic monitoring, as well as volume and fluid balance. So number four was identification of the best endpoints of resuscitation. Number six was how do we determine the optimal dynamic assessment of fluid responsiveness? And coming in at number 10 was the ability to differentiate volume depletion, vasoplegia, and reduced cardiac function. I think the answer to that last one is echocardiography and ultrasound. But I just bring up this study because, well, number one, I authored it. And then number two, and perhaps more importantly, we still have ongoing issues in terms of figuring out what the best endpoints are and when we can start de-resuscitating patients. So I think the vast majority of the talk is now going to center in on the hemodynamic assessment and specific endpoints of resuscitation when it comes to hemodynamics. And then we'll spend a little bit of time talking about biomarkers as well as regional endpoints as well. So let's go through it. I mean, when you think about assessing a patient initially outside of looking, listening, and feeling, we're going to want to get a sense as to what their blood pressure is. And as I've already alluded to, you got to figure out who your patient is. And the MAP is going to be titrated based on their specific pathology, whether it's TBI versus septic shock. And in patients with septic shock, we're typically targeting MAPs of 65. Well, what about in trauma? We know that in penetrating torso injuries, and again, you'll notice this study was published in 1994, but even back in the 1920s, Walter Cannon was talking about this exact principle, namely not resuscitating wounded soldiers on the battlefield until they were ready to have their bleeding staunched or get bleeding control. And so much of this sort of back and forth happens, as I'm sure you're all well aware. But in this particular study in Houston, Texas, they looked at immediate versus delayed resuscitation for hypotensive patients. And in fact, what they found was that if you were just to put in a peripheral IV, scoop and run to the nearby trauma center, and then hold off on crystalloid resuscitation until you got up to the operating room and had hemorrhage control, that in fact, virtually every outcome that they looked at, and most importantly, survival, is improved in patients who undergo delayed resuscitation. This is something that's been adopted by the U.S. military, and it's something that we've adopted at our trauma centers nationwide, and I hope across the world. And so when your patient first comes in, feel for a pulse. If they got a palpable radial, 80 systolic, palpable femoral, 70, palpable carotid, 60. If they've got a palpable pulse anywhere, and they've got some level of mentation with penetrating torso injuries, do not resuscitate these patients. The whole idea is we want to avoid popping the clot and artificially raising the MAP or mean arterial pressure until we have or are ready to get control. So the whole idea behind MAP and blood pressure, I think, is that it may or may not be useful, but the most important thing is understand when and whom you're applying your endpoints to. We did a study a couple of years ago looking at a narrowed pulse pressure. And as you remember from the ACS classification of hemorrhage shock, narrowed pulse pressure is one of those things that will decrease in patients as they become progressively more hypovolemic. Why does that happen? Well, we already talked about the sympathetic response and catecholamine release. That's going to result in beta adrenergic stimulation, as well as increased vascular tone or SVR in an effort to maintain mean arterial pressure, which is equal to your cardiac output times your SVR. So very early in hypovolemic shock, what happens is patients actually have an elevated diastolic. And so you may see an initial blood pressure reading in the trauma bay in a patient who's sick, and it reads 160 over 140. And I can't tell you the number of times I've heard people remark, oh, they're fine, they've got a normal blood pressure. There's nothing normal about a diastolic of 140, and especially in someone who's at risk for bleeding. And with that pulse pressure less than 30, that should always alert you and concern you that this patient is in fact bleeding. And about 9 or 8 times out of 10, the next blood pressure is going to be 60. The other value that we looked at, in addition to the utility of a narrowed pulse pressure in predicting the need for either an emergent operative procedure or a massive transfusion, was a shock index. And the shock index is another helpful triage tool that's actually been demonstrated in both large national database studies as well as single institutional retrospective studies and prospective observational studies to actually predict the need for emergent surgical interventions or transfusion. And the shock index is really just your heart rate divided by your blood pressure. So you can imagine someone who's exsanguinating, their blood pressure is going to be low, so their shock index will be high, or their heart rate will be up, also increasing their shock index. So there's various thresholds. We used a very generous threshold of 0.7. Most studies would include a shock index greater than 1. As being predictive of the need for intervention. So again, when it comes to mean arterial pressure, again, it's usually available and interpretable. But again, there really are no universal MAP goals to guide therapy. And again, normalization of blood pressure does not equal absence of shock. And if you look back at the original Rivers trial, they had a significant chunk of patients who actually met that MAP goal of 65, yet they still demonstrated evidence of hyperlactatemia and other metabolic abnormalities that were consistent with ongoing tissue hyperperfusion and hypoxia. CVP, I think these days, for any of you who have been through the ICU recently, this is something that we kind of laugh and joke about. When I was a resident, this is something that we used all the time, and this guided our resuscitation. And so if you weren't intubated on a ventilator and your CVP was less than 8, you got fluids. You're on a ventilator, your CVP was less than 12, you got fluids. We now know that the sort of ability of CVP to determine fluid responsiveness is 50-50. It's really a coin flip. And so very rarely do we use CVP in the management of critically ill patients. I think it still has a role in patients maybe with right heart failure and really kind of in demonstrating elevated right-sided filling pressures. But in terms of its ability to determine fluid responsiveness, it's really gone by the wayside. Now, with that said, there is a measurement that we can get off of a central line that is potentially helpful, and that would be your central venous oxygen saturation. And this just provides us with a global overview of the balance between oxygen delivery and oxygen consumption. And in the average adult, we always can remember that their cardiac output is typically 5 liters per minute, or about 80 cc's per kg. Well, in about a minute, about a liter of oxygen goes out into the peripheral tissues. And in a normal resting condition, about 250 cc's are extracted. Whether or not they're actually utilized or not, we don't know. Meaning that the blood returning to the right side of the heart should have a saturation of about 75%. And so when the SVO2 is low, well, this can provide us with some helpful information. And again, this is where that oxygen delivery equation comes back into play. So is this a problem with the pump, or is this a problem with oxygen content versus increased consumption? And so in patients who do have a central line in, particularly in the setting of hemorrhagic shock and potentially septic shock, if their SVO2 is low, this is a nice conceptual framework to figuring out and troubleshooting why that may be. And again, the typical sort of sequence in terms of interventions is fill them, press them, squeeze them. And in trauma patients, obviously transfusion. Not going to get into it too much, but we still do use Swan-Ganz catheters. And I think if you're in a CCU or CVICU or even liver ICU, this is something that you're also using quite frequently. We don't use it routinely. And certainly when you look at this series of NHLBI studies looking at the potential utility of protocol-directed Swan-Ganz catheter resuscitation of critically ill patients, using a Swan-Ganz catheter may actually decrease your duration of mechanical ventilation and ICU length of stay, but really has no significant impact on hard outcomes like mortality. But in patients with undifferentiated shock, despite application of ultrasound or echocardiography, I would strongly urge you to consider placing a Swan-Ganz catheter. Again, this is another one of those skills that seems to have fallen by the wayside. And understanding the physiology and what these indices mean, I think, is really important. There certainly are several limitations to the use of PA catheters. And the main one being most people don't know how to interpret the numbers or, more importantly, the waveforms. And again, there are several derived values and numerous assumptions upon which those values are derived that make some of these interpretations difficult. I think the next two hemodynamic measurements are the ones that have really kind of come into play in the ICU in the last 5 to 10 years. The first one is arterial pulse waveform or stroke volume variability. And there's a variety of different companies as well as machines that can measure this automatically. All you need is an A-line. Before we had the funds to purchase a whole lot of these, we actually just used our Philips monitors to calculate pulse pressure variability, and I'll show you how to do that. And the whole idea behind pulse pressure variability in its simplest form is that when a patient is on positive pressure ventilation, and I think that's the first take-home point here, is that this only works on patients who are mechanically ventilated, not spontaneously breathing. But in patients who are on a ventilator, that increase in intrathoracic pressure that accompanies inspiration is accompanied by an overall decrease in their LV preload as well as LV systolic function so that the actual amount of blood or the LV ejection is decreased. But there's a little bit of an electromechanical delay between what you see on your EKG and the changes that you're going to see on your A-line, such that patients who have hypovolemia, or more specifically, patients who may be fluid responsive, meaning if I give a fluid challenge, they will improve their hemodynamics. There's a delay such that you'll see this undulation in the arterial waveform, and that undulation, that minimal peak, is lowest during expiration. So you can actually look at the pulse pressure of the highest or largest waveform minus the lowest waveform and divide it by the mean of the two. And if the value is greater than 13%, your patient is fluid responsive. And this is a Philips monitor. You don't need fancy equipment to do this, but you have to have the right preconditions. If you just tap on your actual A-line waveform and then change the speed and narrow it down, you get a waveform that looks like this. And you can actually see that there's some phasic variability with respirations. If you freeze that wave, you can then take your PP max minus your PP min divided by the mean of the two times 100%. And if it's greater than 13%, your patient is fluid responsive. So this is a nicer, perhaps more academic way of determining whether or not patients will respond to fluids. And I think one of the major points I need to emphasize here is that just because someone is fluid responsive, it does not mean that they need fluids. I think the common underlying theme whenever we're talking about endpoints of resuscitation is that you never use one endpoint in isolation and use a constellation of symptoms, signs, and adjuncts to make the determination. Now, is this really that important? Why not just give 500 cc's or a liter? Well, just look at any patient that's been in the ICU for 2 or 3 days. They're swollen up. They're probably 4 or 5 liters positive, and that accumulates over time. And so I think we're really moving away from the giving fluid boluses in the form of 500 or 1,000 cc's and actually moving more towards things like passive leg raising or a fluid challenge, which is a much smaller aqualot of fluids to see if there's a response using objective criteria like echocardiography. And we looked at the utility of ultrasound as well as pulse pressure variability in a recent EAST PMG. And essentially, when we looked at both focused ultrasound and arterial pressure waveform analysis, we give the conditional recommendation that this should be used to assess fluid responsiveness in order to decrease both complications, organ failure, and not so much mortality. I mean, if you actually look at the forest plots for organ failure, it certainly does seem to favor arterial pressure waveform analysis. When it comes to mortality, though, really no significant impact. Now, this is one of those algorithms that's provided by one of the manufacturers of the arterial pressure waveform analysis devices, the FlowTrack. And what you'll see time and time again is that, again, it really does come down to the O2 delivery equation. And working through this systematically and finding that balance between delivery as well as consumption. And there are numerous devices available. Here we use FlowTrack Vigileo. There's the Litgo Volume Vipico. The list goes on and on. It all depends on how much money you're willing to spend, but they all pretty much do the same thing, and they don't outperform that ghetto harbor method that I just showed you. Don't need to get into this into too much detail. Now, there are several limitations, and I see this being used incorrectly all the time. Number one, like I said, patients got to be on a ventilator. If they're being ventilated, they typically need to have reasonable tidal volumes to induce some of these changes in the pulse pressure. So in general, we say at least 8 to 10 cc's per kg. So if you've got a patient who's ARDS, severe COVID, and they're getting low tidal volume ventilation, that may not be enough to induce some of these cyclical or variations in their pulse pressure. The other thing is these patients that have been studied, that have looked at fluid responsiveness and the utility of pulse pressure variability, have by and far been patients with septic shock. So this may not apply to patients who have hypovolemia or are in cardiogenic shock, and certainly will not work in patients with RV failure. The other key point to bear in mind is that patients need to be in normal sinus rhythm. Okay, so those are the three major criteria for using this. Echocardiography and ultrasound, I think this really is modern day critical care. And so for those of you who are interested in ICU medicine, I would strongly encourage you to take out that ultrasound probe and assess every single one of your patients that you're concerned about shocking in order to get used to the different views. There's so many things that we can do with ultrasound. We can look at both static as well as dynamic measures of fluid responsiveness. And it can be something as simple as just measuring the IVC. Now, this isn't exactly the most accurate way of assessing fluid responsiveness. And here's an example of M mode where we have a patient sniff, and you can see that this is the IVC, that when they sniff, there's significant collapsibility to that IVC. The opposite applies when someone's on a positive pressure ventilator, whereby we're looking for IVC distensibility. But you can do different calculations and you'll realize that they all look pretty similar. Whether you're looking at the mean or the max or the min all depends on what exactly you're trying to calculate and whether or not your patient's ventilated or not. But just IVC diameter alone may be potentially helpful. We know that phasic or respiratory changes in diameter are certainly helpful in predicting fluid responsiveness in septic patients. But outside of just looking at the IVC and the size of the IVC, more importantly, we want to look at cardiac function and calculate things like their velocity time integrals. And this can be done with TTE, it doesn't have to be TEE, although you will find these days that there is an ever-expanding role of TEE, both in the emergency room, not just the operating room, and also in the ICU. And so there's many different ways of looking at fluid responsiveness, and VTIs probably right now is sort of the gold standard in determining fluid responsiveness. And this is really just measuring velocities or flows across the aortic valve. And similar calculations in terms of looking at the maximal LV or left ventricular outflow tract minus the min divided by the mean. And again, the numbers are always somewhere between 10 to 20%. And if it's greater than that, that patient will be fluid responsive. Now, despite extensive experience with ultrasound, I got to say, especially in our surgical patients, there are a lot of limitations. If, you know, number one is the expertise and the sort of experience to make reliable calculations. I think there's a big difference between qualitatively looking at an LV and saying that function is reduced versus quantifying something like VTIs or velocity time integrals. The other problem with our surgical patients is a lot of them have open abdomens and other complicating factors that obscure our views or windows, which again, that's where TEE would play an important role. I mentioned the role of passive leg raising a little bit earlier, and so I just want to touch upon this a little bit, because in fact, when you actually look at diagnostic accuracy of all these different tests for fluid responsiveness, passive leg raising is actually the most accurate and has the best likelihood ratios for fluid responsiveness, yes or no. And how do we do it? Oftentimes I'll see patients are already relatively supine, hopefully their bed's greater than 30 degrees. People come over, kind of lift the legs up, look at the monitor to see if there's an improvement in their hemodynamics and say yes or no to fluid responsiveness. The whole premise of passive leg raising really falls on the fact that the majority of our preload or volume is within the vena cava at any given time in the cardiac cycle. And so by actually placing the patient supine and elevating their legs, patients actually generate an autobolus of about 250 to 300 cc's, which should be detectable if you're using some form of cardiac output monitoring. It's not good enough just to look up at the A-line tracing. You need objective data, either in the form of echocardiography or ultrasound VTIs, or if you have some sort of non-invasive monitor like the CHITA, which can actually look at changes in fluid responsiveness based on pulse pressure variability. And it's a nice non-invasive way of doing it. But here's the key steps. First, make sure that they're already at 45 degrees and try not to disturb your patient. Ideally, they're sedated and you're going to put their head down and bring their legs up. And most of these beds these days can do this and put them into about 45 degrees. once you do that, you want to assess, again, by VTIs, or if they've got a Swan in, or if they've got, you know, a pulse pressure variability monitor, whether or not there's an actual increase in the cardiac output. So you need some real-time measurement of cardiac output. And if there is, well, then that patient is fluid responsive. And in those particular cases, we would consider volume expansion in an effort to improve their hemodynamic profile. And this has been shown in several studies, most of which are single center and involve primarily medical critical care patients, to predict fluid responsiveness in critically ill patients. Again, in surgical patients, especially in a busy trauma ICU, we have numerous limitations like an open abdomen. Patients may have severe pelvic or bilateral lower extremity fractures, which might prevent us from being able to perform such maneuvers. And we really don't know too much about the effect of things like intra-abdominal hypertension, as might be seen in a cirrhotic or a patient with an open abdomen, on the passive leg raising to predict fluid responsiveness. In terms of metabolic endpoints, lactate and base deficit, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about these because I think in the trauma population, there have been numerous studies that have shown that both the admission lactate or base deficit is predictive of mortality, and ability to clear your lactate or base deficit in the first 24 hours is also associated with improved survival. Now, there are pros and cons to both of them. We, at our hospital here, essentially anyone over the age of 65 in all of our top tier traumas will have a lactate or base deficit drawn as part of their initial resuscitation. And we just do a point of care. And so we have the information within 2 minutes of sticking it through the point of care device. And then that helps to triage our patients. Unfortunately, a lot of patients that we've noticed actually come in with some elevation in either their BD or lactate. And that reflexively generates this autobolus reflex or response. So I think it's really helpful when these are normal. It kind of helps us kind of put down our guard. But when it's elevated, that's when we can get into this vicious cycle of chasing those lactates until they're completely normalized, which we don't need to do. Again, remember that lactate in general, we think of as a marker for anaerobic metabolism, but it can be elevated for any number of reasons, especially in the ICU. So not even thinking about our trauma patients, but your general critical care patients, let's say with septic shock. Lactates can be elevated in patients with decreased liver and sometimes renal disease. We know that the vast majority of lactates metabolized in the liver, but a number of drugs may also result in lactate production. So we want to make that distinction between type A and type B lactic acidosis. A classic example here is patients who are receiving epinephrine infusions, whereby that sort of increased beta agonism can result in generation of lactate, which is non-ischemic mediated. In terms of the regional modalities, we'll maybe spend one slide on that. I think the one study I do want to talk about is this Andromeda shock study that was published last year, and this was presented at last year's Clinical Congress. The reason I like this study, so this is a prospective randomized controlled trial down in South America across several hospitals. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to compare a strategy of peripheral perfusion status. So essentially looking at capillary refill in your finger versus serum lactate levels and trending those and the impact on 28-day mortality in patients with septic shock. And essentially, what they found was that although it looks like there's a difference here, there's not. There is no statistically significant difference between following or trending lactates versus just assessing their peripheral perfusion. And why I find this study interesting is I love how it brings us as clinicians back to the bedside to examine our patients. And I've always had this bias that skin gives us a lot of information. You know, in early septic shock, patients are oftentimes warm and vasodilated. As that process progresses, they'll become more like a cardiogenic patient where they've got high SVR. And so I think assessing cap refill and skin is really important. And here, it's not like it was worse than doing lactates. So please examine your patients, get to the bedside. There's a whole host of information that can be gotten simply by laying hands on our patients. In terms of the other resuscitation endpoints, you'll notice these pictures are kind of old. I mean, these technologies have been around for a long time, whether it's sublingual capnometry, gastric tonometry, or STO2 monitoring. The fact of the matter is, these really have never caught on. And in particular, the STO2 monitor, you know, it performs worse. The more important is to know what the patient's perfusion is. And all of these rely pretty much on capillary or microcirculatory flow and accumulation of metabolic byproducts like CO2. The STO2, this is something that I used a lot in fellowship, never panned out. And so it's something that had some promise, gone by the wayside. And I don't have any experience using either of these modalities. I think with the publication of the PROPER trial, as well as the expanding role of thromboelastography, hemostatic resuscitation and hemorrhage control has become this fourth resuscitation endpoint. We're now beginning to really understand that there's a lot more to the coagulopathy of trauma than simply bleeding, acidosis, and hypothermia. And I think that with the publication of the PROPER trial and our understanding that a one-to-one-to-one strategy may actually result in improved hemostasis and may very early on be associated with improved survival, that the vast majority of trauma centers have moved to this route. Also, thromboelastography is something we actually just introduced 2 weeks ago here, and we're really excited about it. But really being able to guide our resuscitative efforts based on real-time dynamic data versus having to rely on something in a test tube in the form of a PTT or INR is a real game changer. So I think looking at the ability to achieve hemostasis, looking at improvements in their coagulation profile using TEG or ROTEM is another significant advance in understanding endpoints of resuscitation. So I know that's a lot of information, but in terms of take-home points, I think there's a few key things that I'd love for you to take away from this talk. And number one, and perhaps more importantly, there is no one ideal endpoint. Endpoints are going to vary depending both on your patient as well as the disease process that you're treating. These resuscitation endpoints broadly can be divided into hemodynamic, metabolic, and regional. And I think most of the interesting research and developments have really been with regards to the hemodynamic endpoints of resuscitation. Please, please, please remember, technology will never supplement our clinical acumen, or it supplements our clinical acumen, does not replace it. And so these are just data points in time. Look at the whole clinical picture. And remember, diagnosis in the absence of an active intervention is purely academic. In terms of future directions, I think there's a lot that's happening currently and will be happening in the future. And so improving accuracy of our non-invasive measurements is something that we're ever looking at. The expanding role for artificial intelligence and better use of the EHR in terms of, you know, reacting to subtle changes in physiology, I think are important, as well as the emergence of improved biomarkers and personalized medicine. And we're seeing a lot of this, some groundbreaking research being done, particularly in the areas of SIRS, sepsis, and septic shock. So I think with that, I will leave it there, and I would be happy to entertain any questions. And thank you very much for the invitation and for speaking with you today. I really appreciate it, friends.